From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
In another bad day for the Bush administration, the Red Cross announced that the conduct of the U.S. in Guantanamo was tantamount to torture. And lawyers as well filed a case in Berlin, Germany, against top U.S. Defense Department officials and others for torture, both in Iraq and in Guantanamo.
We go to Germany to speak with Center for Constitutional Rights President Michael Ratner. He is involved in a lawsuit charging Donald Rumsfeld and former CIA chief George Tenet with war crimes. Then we take a look at the Sudan, where two aid agencies have been expelled. And as voter fraud in the Ukraine elections dominates headlines, we'll look further at the U.S. elections and calls for a recount in Ohio. We'll speak with the Reverend Jesse Jackson and a lawyer filing suit in Ohio. Then we go to Minneapolis to talk to an Iraqi American who is living the American dream. He became a U.S. citizen, had a successful restaurant, but has decided to leave it all behind and return to his home in Iraq.
I would do anything, anything. Probably I'll start cleaning the streets where my sister lives and get those kids who like to listen to their uncle to come and help me, and probably we do a lots of things and get the people influenced by rebuilding their country again.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Committee of the Red Cross has concluded the U.S. has been intentionally using psychological and sometimes physical coercion tantamount to torture on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. This according to a report in the New York Times today. The conclusion comes in a confidential report written by the Red Cross based on information the group obtained during a visit to Guantanamo in June. The Red Cross also found experienced medical personnel at the base committed, quote, a flagrant violation of medical ethics by participating in the planning for the interrogations of prisoners. Doctors reportedly shared detailed information about the mental health of detainees to interrogators. The U.S. has rejected the charges of the Red Cross. NBC News is reporting the Pentagon now plans to increase the number of U.S. troops in Iraq by up to 11,000 in the lead-up to the January elections. This will bring the total number of U.S. troops in Iraq to 150,000. Meanwhile, at least 134 U.S. troops have died so far this month in Iraq, making it nearly the deadliest month for the military. In April, 135 soldiers died. The British medical charity MedAct has concluded the Iraqi health system is in far worse condition now than before the U.S. invaded the country over 18 months ago. The charity said hospitals are plagued by poor sanitation, shortages of drugs, and a shrinking number of qualified staff members. To make matters worse, 12% of Iraq's hospitals have been damaged so far in the war, and the country's two main public health laboratories have been destroyed. The charity group MedAct also challenged the British government to set up a commission that will count the Iraqi civilian dead and wounded. President Bush is making his first official state visit to Canada today in an attempt to patch up relations with Ottawa, which opposed the U.S. invasion. Bush will be making stops in Ottawa and Halifax, but the BBC reports he won't be addressing the Canadian Parliament because of the risk of being heckled by Canadian lawmakers. In Halifax, a mock war crimes trial will take place later today to try Bush for crimes committed in Iraq. The legal group Lawyers Against War has said Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin should issue a warrant for President Bush's arrest for breaking the country's Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act. The legal group called on Ottawa to deny Bush's entry into Canada because Canadian immigration law bars entry to, quote, those who've engaged in gross violations of human rights. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Center for Constitutional Rights is filing a criminal complaint today on behalf of four Iraqi citizens who allege a group of U.S. officials committed war crimes in Iraq. The Iraqis claim they were victims of electric shock, severe beatings, sleep and food deprivation, and sexual abuse. Among the officials named in the complaint, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, former CIA Director George Tenet. Germany's laws on torture and war crimes permit the prosecution of suspected war criminals wherever they may be found. Ukraine's parliament is meeting in an emergency session today to debate a motion of no confidence in Viktor Yanukovych, the country's pro-Russian prime minister who's been the declared winner of last week's presidential election. The country's Supreme Court has entered a second day of closed-door deliberations to determine if the election was rigged. And pro-Western opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko said that if the Electoral Commission decides to hand him the presidency, he will offer the post of prime minister to his opponent. However, Yushchenko said if the Supreme Court rules a new election should take place, he would propose neither he nor his opponent, Yanukovych, should run. In a video aired on Al Jazeera, Osama bin Laden's top deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, vowed that al-Qaeda should continue to fight the U.S. until Washington changes its policies. He said, quote, "We are a nation of patience, and we will continue fighting you until the last hour." NBC reports al-Qaeda has carried out major attacks following broadcast statements by al-Zawahiri on seven previous occasions. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has quietly released a study that sharply criticizes the Bush administration's war on terror and its effect on the Muslim world. The Pentagon's report concludes, quote, "Muslims do not hate our freedom, but rather they hate our policies." The report goes on to state, quote, "The overwhelming majority voice their objections to what they see as one-sided support in favor of Israel and against Palestinian rights, and the longstanding, even increasing support for what Muslims collectively see as tyrannies, most notably Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Pakistan, and the Gulf states." The report was released late on Wednesday afternoon, the day before Thanksgiving. The Supreme Court decided Monday not to take up a challenge to the country's only law that sanctions same-sex marriage. Conservative groups were hoping the Supreme Court would take the case and rule that the Massachusetts Supreme Court had unconstitutionally allowed same-sex couples to marry. An attorney for the conservative group said in a Supreme Court filing that the Constitution should, quote, "protect the citizens of Massachusetts from their own state Supreme Court's usurpation of power." The court Monday did hear arguments in a medical marijuana case. The federal government's prosecuting two California women who grow and use marijuana for health reasons. In other court news, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the private universities can bar military recruiters from campus without the risk of losing federal funding as a result. The court ruled, quote, "In a free society, the government cannot co-opt private institutions to issue the government's message." President Bush has nominated the head of Kellogg's to become the new Secretary of Commerce. Carlos Gutierrez is a Cuban-born businessman who's worked for Kellogg's for decades, initially as a salesman in Mexico City. The Washington Post reports President Bush sees his background in sales as a crucial credential since, quote, "Bush has used his economic team primarily to promote the White House agenda rather than to make policy." And the Baltimore Sun is reporting the NAACP president, Kwasi Mfume, is planning to step down from his post. He's headed the organization since 1996. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Committee of the Red Cross has concluded the U.S. has been intentionally using psychological and sometimes physical coercion tantamount to torture on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. This according to a front-page piece in the New York Times today. The conclusion comes in a confidential report written by the Red Cross based on information the group obtained during a visit to Guantanamo in June. The report also concludes the military had set up a system at Guantanamo devised to break the will of prisoners and make them wholly dependent on their interrogators through, quote, humiliating acts, solitary confinement, temperature extremes, use of forced positions. The U.S. has rejected the charges. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Center for Constitutional Rights is filing a criminal complaint today on behalf of four Iraqi citizens who allege that U.S. officials have committed war crimes in Iraq. The Iraqis claim they were victims of electric shock, severe beatings, sleep and food deprivation, as well as sexual abuse. Among the officials named, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the former director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet. Germany's laws on torture and war crimes permit the prosecution of suspected war criminals wherever they may be found. We go now to Berlin to Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Can you explain what this lawsuit is all about?
Well, Germany has the best single law probably in the world right now for prosecuting alleged war criminals. You can prosecute them anywhere in the world. They have universal jurisdiction. And we decided to come to Germany partly on the basis of that law and partly on the basis that three of the people involved in torture are actually in Germany. Ricardo Sanchez, who is the general in charge of all of the military bases in Iraq as well as the Iraq War during the Abu Ghraib period, his deputy, Major Wojtkowski, and Colonel Pappas. They're all at U.S. military bases in Germany, so that gives you even another handle. They're actually here. They're people who we allege were deeply involved in the abuses and torture that took place. Germany is different than the United States in the sense that you can actually bring a criminal complaint, and the prosecutor has to do something with it. He has to either investigate it, go ahead and do something, indict people, or he could reject it, but in that case, you can always go to a court. We decided this really, we've been working on it for a number of months. The German complaint is 160-some pages. It's quite detailed. Most of it is based on the public record of what these people have authorized over a period of years. We came here really for two reasons. One is the U.S. is not doing anything to investigate the chain of command going up. The investigations are a complete fraud. There's only criminal indictments at best against low-level officials. And there's nowhere in you can turn in international courts anymore. The U.S. isn't in the ICC. So this is a really, I consider this a major and important initiative, and it'll really say whether the German law has the teeth that it should and whether or not big torturers like the United States can get away with setting an agenda that is taking us into the dark ages. Coming on the heels of course, the Guantanamo article in the Times, it's quite extraordinary, coupled with the attempts to keep Bush out of Canada right now that are being made on the grounds that their immigration law doesn't allow war criminals or people who violate laws of war into Canada. So we're really trying to make, I think, this world right now as uncomfortable for these people in the administration as we can.
Michael Ratner, can you talk about this report on the front page of the New York Times today? Red Cross finds detainee abuse at Guantanamo. A confidential report calls practice tantamount to torture. You're representing some of the detainees at Guantanamo.
Yes, and I wasn't pleased at what I saw in the report, but I've known about this for a long time. In fact, they talk about what happened to three of our clients, the Tipton Three from the United Kingdom, who told me their stories in March, that really March of this year, that track exactly what happened, what the New York Times article says, from shackling to isolation to stripping, a whole range of conduct, both psychological and physical, that now the Red Cross says, as of June 2004, that are tantamount to torture. And what's extraordinary to me is this is like the emperor has no clothes. Everybody in the world knows the U.S. is engaging in everything from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, to torture. They're doing it around the world. They're doing it in Guantanamo. They're doing it in Bagram. They're doing it in Iraq. And the United States insists, as Donald Rumsfeld says in that article, or as the Pentagon spokesman says, we treat people humanely. The world has become utterly Orwellian for the United States. War is peace. Torture is humane treatment. And that article is just extraordinary because it does detail exactly what happened to our clients, the center's clients, in Guantanamo, and it's one of the reasons we're here in Germany. When you can call that treatment humane treatment, we have a world and we have a government. We have a government that has to be changed, that something has to be done, that these people have to be held accountable. In 10 years or 20 years from now, I don't want to see us then finally write a nunca mas, you know, like they did in Argentina, you know, after all of the tortures that took place there. We should do something about it now. And what's amazing is this is not in the past. This is continuing today. What's going on in Guantanamo, what's going on in detention facilities around the world is continuing today. And our highest level government officials are authorizing it, condoning it, and then trying to say, oh, no, it's a few bad soldiers. But that's not the case.
Michael Ratner, the Red Cross report goes on to say, quote, the construction of such a system whose stated purpose is the production of intelligence cannot be considered other than an intentional system of cruel, unusual, and degrading treatment and a form of torture. I wanted to ask you about that link to Congress expanding its threats to cut off aid, both military and civil aid, to countries which refuse to guarantee immunity to Americans from prosecution by the International Criminal Court.
Well, it's all related, Amy. I mean, what I've always said about our refusal to even join the International Criminal Court, and now our desire or our efforts to enter special agreements with these courts, with these countries, and to cut off aid, it's related to our highest government officials know that they are engaged in basic violations of the laws of war and humanitarian law, and they don't want to be prosecuted anywhere in the world, and they want their soldiers to be able to carry those illegal acts out all over the world without with impunity from prosecution. And it goes right to the Gonzales memo that was written in January 2002 when he said, well, we better not say the Geneva Conventions apply, because if Geneva applies, we can be charged with war crimes under Geneva, and the best defense is to simply say they don't apply. So what we're doing around the world is we're coercing countries with our political, economic, and military power into saying the United States is not just exceptional in its many ways it thinks, but is exceptional even in the sense that the laws prohibiting torture should not apply to it. It's an extraordinary moment, one that is taking us back really to the Middle Ages.
Finally, Michael Ratner, President Bush making his first state visit to Canada today, and Lawyers Against War, a legal organization, has called on the Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin, to issue a warrant for President Bush's arrest for breaking the country's Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act.
What they've actually done in Canada is say that because Bush is president, he can't actually be prosecuted right now in Canada until he's out of office, but that he should be barred from entering Canada because alleged war criminals, people who violate humanitarian law, cannot come into Canada, and he should be barred from coming into Canada. And it is true. Their law is very clear on that. And if the Canadians have any guts, that's what they'll do. But unfortunately, although the world knows that this country, the United States, is now harboring torturers at the highest level, so far we haven't seen people stand up. I want to say one more word about the German case. We're going to need support all over the world to make sure that prosecutor really does an investigation. If people visit the CCR website, ccr-ny.org, they will in a few hours find a letter they can send directly to the German prosecutor, urging the German prosecutor to begin a serious investigation. But really, we're facing a moment that's a very bad moment in terms of what the U.S. is doing, but a very good moment in that lawyers and other activists all over the world are really pursuing these torturers to the end of the earth. We call them, in our legal jargon, enemies of all humankind who can be brought to justice wherever found, and that is what we have to do.
Michael Ratner, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. When we come back, as we talk about war crimes, we're going to talk about the Sudan. We're also going to look at the Ohio vote count with Reverend Jesse Jackson. And we're going to meet a man from Minneapolis. His name is Sami Rizzouli. He's an Iraqi-American who's decided to pack in his life here and go home to Najaf in Iraq. Back in a moment.
We're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man. Yeah. To see the unification of all Africans.
Bob Marley, Africa Unite. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman, as we broadcast in the largest public media collaboration in this country, broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations, Pacifica and NPR stations, university, community, college stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. As we talk now about the Sudan, which has decided to postpone a decision to expel the heads of two British aid agencies, Oxfam and Save the Children, citing administrative difficulties and humanitarian grounds. The Sudanese State Minister for Humanitarian Affairs said, quote, "This is an administrative decision which we did not realize all the implications of." Both organizations are still on notice for what the ministry has said was interfering on political issues forbidden by Sudanese law governing emergency aid agencies working in the country. Save the Children, one of the largest food distributors in Darfur, had issued a statement last week accusing the government of dropping a bomb near one of its feeding centers. Oxfam had criticized a UN Security Council resolution issued in Nairobi earlier this month, which contained weaker wording on the possibility of sanctions against Sudan than previous resolutions. The news comes days after the World Food Program announced it's suspending much of its relief operations in Darfur because of resumed fighting, leaving an estimated 300,000 refugees without aid. We turn now to Sally Booker. He is director of Africa Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about what's happening right now in the Sudan?
Well, the situation specifically with Oxfam and Save the Children sort of highlights the impossible dilemma that humanitarian organizations are in. Of course, Oxfam has been operating there for 20 years. It's providing food to 300,000 people. And Save the Children, as you mentioned, is one of the largest food distributors. At a moment when the UN is describing the crisis in Darfur as the world's largest complex humanitarian crisis, what it reveals is that this new violence that is occurring, or the continuing violence, I should say, you know, threatens the relief efforts. And the failure of the UN Security Council to take any stronger measure, or for that matter, the African Union or the European Union, you know, none of the regional or international organizations that have the capacity to stop what is happening in Darfur have acted sufficiently. So the humanitarian organizations are in an impossible position where they can't provide relief to those who need it, and they're obviously witness to the violence that's going on, to the government using warplanes to bomb civilian installations. And this is essentially what's been going on since last year. This crisis is 22 months old. There are 2 million people internally displaced in Sudan. There are 200,000 refugees across the border in Chad, and an estimated estimates up to 300,000 people have been killed, most of them, two-thirds two-thirds of them due to the violence of the government, the army, the police, its militias in Darfur. And this violence, in the end, constitutes genocide, but the international community has failed to act to provide the protection necessary to civilians in Darfur.
Sally Booker, you were just listening to the conversation with Michael Ratner as we talk quite often about the issue of war crimes in Iraq and Guantanamo. How does that relate in terms of holding officials accountable to what's happening in the Sudan?
Well, it relates in several ways. One, very clearly, you have international law. You have the International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide going back to 1948. And here you have a situation where the U.S. government has acknowledged that there is a genocide occurring. It meets the terms of the International Convention and at the same time turns around and says, but no further action is required because they're not prepared to live up to the obligations of that convention, and the UN is still hesitating even on a determination. Then you have the related problem of the fact that the United States, because of its actions in Iraq, in Guantanamo Bay, has no international credibility or legitimacy as a voice for upholding international law, international treaties, and prosecuting war crimes. And so we have a horrible situation where it is the innocents who are without recourse to call on any international body or a powerful nation to uphold international law when they, in fact, are the victims of these extreme abuses. And, you know, there's no greater war crime than the crime of genocide that continues to unfold in Western Sudan.
The African Union has been investigating the whole situation in Darfur, a delegation going. Can you explain the significance of this delegation and what it means?
Well, the African Union, to its credit, early on played a positive role in trying to negotiate a resolution to the armed conflict between the rebel movements in Darfur and the government of Sudan. And that dates back to April of this year, the original ceasefire that was signed. They then sent a small delegation of observers, of Rwandans and Nigerians, initially only 300 observers, with no mandate but to just report on violations of the ceasefire, of which there have been many. Then more recently, the African Union decided to slightly modify the mandate and increase the numbers. They're trying to reach a number of 3,500 by the end of this year, which looks entirely unlikely that number would be realized until February of next year. And the African Union simply lacks the capacity to get the troops, equipment, logistics systems, et cetera, operational in Sudan that are necessary to protect this huge number of civilians who are homeless, who are in these camps, and it's mostly women and girls and children, you know, some 2 million people. They don't have access to food, to medicine, to safe water, and while the leading cause of death has been the continuing violence, there's an increase in malnutrition-related disease and deaths due to that, in which the World Health Organization is estimating that some 10,000 people a month are dying just due to malnutrition, starvation, and related illnesses alone.
So Secretary of State Colin Powell went to Sudan. What is the U.S. Congress doing, and what are you saying American people should do right now?
Well, the United States Congress, in an exceptional move in the summer, both the House and the Senate passed these resolutions unanimously, which was unprecedented, declaring that, in their view, what was occurring in Darfur constituted genocide, according to the convention. They're now considering legislation to increase minor sanctions on the Sudanese government, visa restrictions, looking at assets, things of that nature. They've failed to go as far as calling for a ban on companies that are raising capital here in U.S. markets that are invested in the Sudanese economy, particularly the oil industry. But these tools, sanctions, et cetera, these are long-term measures. These don't provide the kind of immediate protection to this large large number of civilians who are completely vulnerable right now. I mean, that is the key critical missing ingredient. And there, indeed, the African Union does have the lead role. It's not adequate, and it sort of represents the international community dumping this responsibility on this nascent organization that's very young and trying to be an improvement upon the old Organization of African Unity. But you've had troops that have even had to take commercial flights to get to Sudan. The U.S. government has provided air transport, at least for several flights of Rwandans and Nigerians, but there's an unwillingness on the part of the U.S., other U.N. actors, or the European Union to commit the kind of support necessary. And it's necessary for three reasons. One is to stop this massive number of rapes that have been going on around these camps and killing, continued killing, and, you know, so to provide protection. Secondly, that facilitates the relief effort, the provision of food, of safe water, et cetera. These humanitarian organizations can't get the aid in unless there's security provided to these camps. And you can't count on the Sudanese government, army, or police to provide that security because they're the perpetrators of these crimes against humanity. Thirdly, if you have that kind of protection force facilitating relief, then you have a climate where you can have political negotiations between the government and the Sudan Liberation Army and the Justice and Equality Movement, the two rebel organizations in Darfur that have been involved in talks hosted by Nigeria and the African Union.
We're just about to go to Nairobi to talk about the anti-landmine conference that's taking place there. The U.S. has refused to sign on. Ethiopia was the latest country yesterday, 144th country to sign on to that. Sally Booker, can you talk about landmines in Sudan?
Well, Sudan is one of the top 10 countries in terms of countries that have the highest concentration of landmines. In fact, four of the top 10 are in Africa, Sudan along with Angola, Mozambique, and Somalia. They're not only in southern Sudan, where they're particularly concentrated there and deadly there, but there are also some in Darfur. In fact, a Scottish and Sudanese staff members of Save the Children were killed in recent months due to landmines. You know, of the 200 million landmines around the world today, they're continuing to kill some 26,000, kill or injure 26,000 people a year. And this international movement to ban landmines is, you know, one of the most successful and creative and important international movements of solidarity in recent years, resulting in the Ottawa Treaty and the 1997 convention to ban landmines. Of course, the United States is the only industrialized country to refuse to sign or accede to the treaty. But in Sudan, it's going to require, as elsewhere in the world, the same major elements, funding for destroying, you know, searching, finding, and destroying existing landmines, assistance to victims of landmines, and, you know, continuing education efforts for communities that are most affected by these landmines. Now, ironically, the Sudanese government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement of South Sudan have, you know, again, recently signed an agreement that should result in a comprehensive settlement by the end of this year. And that would provide, if successful, theoretically, the peaceful environment necessary for a major effort in southern Sudan to remove and destroy the hundreds and thousands of remaining mines in the region.
Finally, Senator Danforth, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, had a special role in Sudan, though not specifically to do with Darfur. Does that weigh in here in any way?
Well, certainly, you know, he was the special envoy on Sudan for the past several years for the Bush administration. He made some contributions in helping to negotiate the protocols between the Khartoum government and the SPLA. Of course, African negotiators were the major leaders of that effort. So he certainly has knowledge and involvement. I think sometimes the U.S. role in promoting that process is a bit exaggerated. But nevertheless, one hopes that peace settlement could be accomplished. He appears to be less knowledgeable, perhaps, on the details of what's going on in Darfur based on his recent media appearances. But certainly in his role within the Security Council, he has been, you know, one of the rare forceful voices on the need for the international community to be more willing to take action in Darfur. Ironically, the principal obstacles in the Security Council, of course, well, not ironically, I mean, simply as a matter of fact, have been China and Russia, China being the major investor in Sudan's growing oil industry, and Russia being a major arms supplier to the government in Khartoum.
Salih Booker, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Salih Booker is the head of Africa Action. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the International Conference on Eradicating Landmines that has opened in Kenya. The conference is the first review of progress in ridding the world of anti-personnel mines since the 1999 Ottawa Convention. Ethiopia became the 144th nation to accept the convention banning these mines. Some 40 countries, including the U.S., China, and Russia, have refused to sign the treaty, which bans the use, production, stockpiling, and transfer of anti-personnel mines and calls for mined areas to be cleared within a decade. The Bush administration has decided not to send any representative to the conference. Actor Danny Glover, making his first trip as a goodwill ambassador, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said, quote, "As a citizen of the U.S., I feel embarrassed and angry." An estimated 20,000 people die of landmine explosions every year. We're joined now by Mark Hisney. He's spokesperson for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch. He joins us from Nairobi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me on today.
It's good to have you with us. Can you explain the significance of this conference?
Marks the fifth year of implementation of the treaty that was negotiated and signed in 1997 to comprehensively ban a weapon, the anti-personnel mine. It's a weapon that claims more civilians than it does military and denies the socioeconomic use of land and claims casualties now ranging somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 people a year. We've been able to document in the year 2003 over 8,600 casualties, but we also recognize that more than half of the incidents go unreported. So this is where the states' parties get together and take stock of how far they've come in 5 years of cooperatively working hand-in-hand with civil society and the UN to implement this treaty, to destroy the weapon, to assist the victims, and to clear the mines. And it's also looking forward to the next 5 years, which in 2009, the first deadlines for states to clear mines that are in the ground start happening. So there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of commitments to be made and followed through on here.
What about the countries that have not signed on? Ethiopia is the latest country, 144, to sign the treaty. What about the United States? Why does the United States hold out? And is it alone in not even sending a representative to the Nairobi conference?
It's kind of a curious situation because no one noticed here. Yes, they knew that the U.S. was not going to send a delegation officially, and they cited cost reasons because the way these conferences happen, the U.S. would have had to bear 20% of the conference cost, which would have been somewhere between $80,000 and $90,000. But they've been putting statements out here that are quite puzzling to the countries that are here, and there are about 43 countries that have not joined the treaty. And over half of them are here. China is here, Russia is here, India is here, Israel is here. All these countries that have used landmines in the recent times, which the United States hasn't used anti-personnel mines since 1991, they're here and they're listening. The U.S. was evidently concerned that the political agenda against against countries that retain the weapon and retain the right to use the weapon would be too severe for them to withstand. In February, the Bush administration announced its new policy of regarding landmines, and it forswore joining this treaty. It said it retains the right to use certain types of anti-personnel mines indefinitely and without geographic restriction. It walked back many years and several commitments of previous administrations. It's collectively so what?
And what about Britain? I mean, Princess Diana made this her number one issue when she was alive.
Well, definitely the role of bringing this issue into the public attention during a critical time when the treaty was being negotiated certainly helped. And the United Kingdom is an active partner in matters of treaty interpretation, resource mobilization, and bringing other countries here, the mine-affected countries that couldn't necessarily afford it, to make sure everyone is represented here. Britain announced today, in fact, with Argentina in a joint statement, that they are beginning cooperation to begin demining the Falkland Islands, which Argentina mined during the conflict there in the early 80s.
Mark Hisney, I want to thank you for being with us, a spokesperson for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, joining us on the line from Nairobi, where the International Conference on Against Landmine, Anti-Personnel Landmines is taking place. When we come back from our break, we're going to Minneapolis to talk with an Iraqi American who's decided to return home to help rebuild his country, Iraq. Then we'll be joined by Reverend Jesse Jackson to talk about what's happening in Ohio. What about the votes there? Will there be a recount? This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Samir Gibran here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For only the second time in 30 years, Iraqi-American Sami Rasuli is returning home to Najaf in Iraq. Sami is leaving his family in Minneapolis. He's a successful restaurateur in South Minneapolis. He grew up in Najaf, considered a holy city among Shia Muslims, about 100 miles from Baghdad. He went to school in Karbala. He left to the United Arab Emirates for a math teaching job. He stayed for 6 years. In 1985, Sami Rasuli came to the United States with his family, originally seeking a medical breakthrough for his oldest son, who's deaf. An experimental procedure didn't work, but Sami Rasuli and his family decided to stay so he could learn English and have a better chance at a career. Sami Rasuli's brother lived in Minnesota at the time, so he moved his family there in 1986 and started with the quintessential immigrant's job, driving a cab. Sami saved his earnings, and in 1990, he opened a restaurant that became a community center in Minneapolis. It's called Sinbad's Cafe and Market. Now, 30 years after leaving Iraq, Sami Rasuli is returning home. Last month, I had a chance to sit with Sami Rasuli in Minneapolis to talk about this decision. He'd become a U.S. citizen, had a successful job here, but is returning home instead. He had made this decision after taking a vacation in Iraq, or rather visiting his family there a while ago, and it was there that he decided that he had to be in Iraq. This is some of what Sami Rasuli had to say.
I was in a visit after about 27 years back to Iraq last November of 2003. I had when I got there, a mixed feeling of very excited to see my family. I had four sisters with about 30 to 35 nieces and nephews, and a really big, big clan of Al-Shamari, which is, it consists about 3 million people that crossed the Arab Peninsula and migrated a long time ago through the Arab world. But in Najaf and Karbala, I have the most closest relatives who I visited with during my visit. While I was happy meeting them and exchanging the experiences, how they lived, how I lived in the West, I was really destroyed by seeing the amount of the destruction and devastated country after the war, and also the effects of the sanction for the last 12 years.
What was the effect? When you returned to Najaf, where you grew up?
Yes. First I arrived to Karbala, then next day I continued to Najaf. The effect, unfortunately, was negative values that the people were forced to adopt because of the need, the hunger, the unemployment, kids an age, 7 to 12, not at school, outside in the street, trying to find anything, jobs to help their families. The negative effect on their values was the kidnapping was something we never, and the Iraqis never witnessed and have before. They kidnap for ransom, and that's because of the need. Killing and robbing Iraqis as well, visitors, to just acquire their belongings, valuable merchandise or cars and cash. That wasn't something we know about, or just we read about, and we know it's something, it's not in Iraq.
Sami Razuli, an Iraqi-American who has lived for more than 15 years with his family in Minneapolis, deciding to return home to Iraq, to Najaf. He leaves the United States today. We did a half-hour interview, and you can go to our website and hear Sami's story, especially what it meant to meet U.S. soldiers when he returned home for a visit to Iraq. But I just wanted to end with his conclusion as we talked after the half hour, when I asked Sami, well, what will he do in Iraq when he returns?
I would do anything. Anything. Probably I'll start cleaning the streets where my sister lives and get those kids who like to listen to their uncle to come and help me. And probably we do a lots of things and get the people influenced by rebuilding their country again.
Sami Razuli, you can hear the whole interview on our website, democracynow.org. He leaves for his home, Iraq, today. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to election news, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez writes in today's New York Daily News, voter fraud in Ukraine? Give me a break. It's been a month now, and we still don't have a clear count of the votes for our own presidential race from the state of Ohio. For those who may have forgotten, Ohio supposedly assured George W. Bush a second term in the White House, only the most important job on the planet. The morning after the election, we were told Bush was ahead of John Kerry in that state's unofficial count by 139,000 votes, or 2.5%. At the time, there were about 155,000 uncounted provisional ballots, and an unknown number of overseas ballots, but Kerry concluded they would not produce enough of a margin to erase his deficit, so he promptly conceded. At the same time, given the bitter Democratic memories of the 2000 Florida fiasco, he assured his supporters he would fight to have every vote properly counted this time. Within a few days, other problems began to show up in Ohio's preliminary tally, Juan writes. Well, we're joined right now by two guests to talk about Ohio. The Reverend Jesse Jackson's on the line with us. This past Sunday, he appeared at a rally of over 500 people in Columbus, Ohio, to publicly endorse a presidential recount there. Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition is now joined with the Green and Libertarian parties in demanding the recount. We're also joined by Cliff Arnbeck, a public interest lawyer who's filing a lawsuit in the Ohio Supreme Court this week contesting the election. He's co-chair of Alliance for Democracy and chair of the Legal Affairs Committee of Common Cause in Ohio. First, Reverend Jesse Jackson, what have you been doing in Ohio? Why do you feel that a recount could change the outcome of the presidential election?
First of all, this is November the 30th, 28 days later, and the election has not been certified. The judge will not order a recount because there has not yet been a count. Therefore, we need a full and thorough federal investigation. For example, in the spring of the year, a provisional ballot, you could vote any place in the county. By November, Secretary of State had shifted it to you only vote in the precinct. And with some precincts changing, it created big frustrations. Blackwell fought, therefore, for that frustration, it seems to me. So 155,000 ballots have still been counted. There are 92,000 ballots not yet processed, overcount and undercount. The other case in Warren, Ohio, where they declared a homeland security alert, mean no building in Warren is over three stories high, and yet they locked out the press and independent observers. And I think another case that I found to be just astounding, which I'm sure Cliff can talk about, is a black woman, Ellen Conley, ran for state Supreme Court judge in Cuyahoga County in Cleveland, where she is best known. Kerry got 120,000 more votes. The other end of the state, down around Hamilton County, Cincinnati, Butler, Claremont, where she is least well known, she got 190,000 more votes than Kerry. Now, that smells. We need a thorough investigation with forensic computer experts to see whether there are any tampering in those machines, whether there are, in fact, no, whether there is no ability to do an audit trail. Then we need to consider the recount. We first need to have a count.
I'm looking at Juan Gonzalez's piece, where, and this may coincide with what you're talking about. He says, in the fourth ward on Cleveland's east side, two fringe presidential candidates did surprisingly well. In Precinct 4F, located at Benedictine High School, Martin Luther King Drive, Kerry received 290 votes, Bush 21. Michael Perutka, the candidate for the ultra-conservative, anti-immigrant Constitutional Party, an amazing 215 votes. That many black votes for Perutka is about as likely as all those Jewish votes for Buchanan in Florida's Palm Beach County in 2000. He says in virtually all the precincts that he looked at, Kerry's vote was lower than Al Gore's in 2000, even though there was a record turnout in the black community this time, and even though blacks voted overwhelmingly for Kerry. Cliff Arnbeck, can you explain further what this pattern is? Is it a pattern?
Yes, there's a pattern of extensive irregularity in the Ohio election. And in contrast to the conventional election count that's going on now, we have exit polls, which are conducted by news organizations, hiring professionals, using scientific methods to count the votes. And that those exit polls showed Kerry winning the Ohio election. So when you compare those exit polls with the counting that's been going on through this partisan process, it seems pretty clear that we have a serious issue here about who won this election. And the conclusion drawn on the day after the election that Mr. Bush won the election is very much in doubt.
Reverend Jackson, Democracy Now! Just went to Spain and Italy, and on one of the main TV stations called Rai in Rome, the interviewer asked about the election. And I said, well, really, we don't really know who won. And his eyebrows raised very high. And he said, excuse me, Kerry conceded. Haven't you heard? Now, what about this, Reverend Jackson? What about Kerry immediately conceding?
The early concession betrayed the trust of the voters. We have a moral obligation, indeed a legal obligation, to find out that every vote counts. And whether Kerry gets the most votes or not, we must break precedent of fraudulent elections. For Secretary of State, in fact, can be the co-chair of a campaign and run the process. That's like a team owner of a baseball team being the umpire at Game 7 of the World Series. You can't be a team owner and be a referee at the same time. You can't have Catherine Harris and Ken Blackwell as chairs of the campaign and in charge of the process. It taints the credibility of the process at the very beginning.
What about the $51 million that John Kerry has, the largest amount of money a presidential candidate has had after an election? He's not in the black. He's not in the red. He's in the black. Biggest amount of money any presidential candidate has had in history, well over half what George Bush has. He could use that money for a recount. Instead, the poor Green Party is raising the money.
He could take a couple $1 million of that money and hire Cliff Underbeck's law firm and partners, and the common cause lawyers who are credible and bright and able lawyers. You could take a couple $1 million and put a renewed light on Ohio that could determine not only the outcome of this election, but the future of American Democratic elections. You see, we've got to go beyond even this matter. We really need, which we do not have, we need the constitutional right to vote for the president. Federally protected. We do not have the constitutional right to vote for the president. We only have the state's right to vote. We have 50 state separate and unequal elections. Within those states, in Ohio, for example, 88 counties, each running their own machine and their own scheme. We must now go to another level now. Not only should we count these votes, we need an amendment to the Constitution. We need, all Americans need, the constitutional individual right, federally protected right to vote for the president.
Reverend Jackson, have you talked to John Kerry about this?
I did talk with him about the election, and he first thanked us for our continued effort, but will not take a public position, nor offer any resources at this time, substantial resources, to help make it happen. And so we're doing it on our will.
So what's he doing with the $51 million?
I do not know. It makes me think so much, and the reason I congratulate people like Cliff Underbeck and those who are fighting back, the Greens, Libertarians, and others who found common ground. Dr. King got the Nobel Peace Prize, and Lyndon Johnson gave him a White House reception. He said, I thank you very much for the reception, but all Americans need the right to vote. And Johnson said, Dr. King, I like you very much. You know I do not like you. I regard you highly, but I can't grant you the right to vote unilaterally. I just can't. I wish I could, but I can't. The bad news is the Congress can but won't, so you can't have the right to vote. So the president talking. So we went to Selma. The common people rose up. And now, again, the common people must rise up and demand that their vote count. So to me, this campaign in Ohio is not so much about Kerry as it is about Fannie Lou Hamer. It's about Med Gebers. It's about Sterling Goodman Cheney. It's about the people's will to democracy. If we can, if people can fight in big numbers for the will to democracy in Ukraine, we can do no less here.
Reverend Jesse Jackson and Cliff Arnbeck, we thank you very much for being with us. That does it for the program. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Our producers, Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks very much for joining us.